Okay.
Why don't you leave it here, miss?
Just leave it here.
Thank you all for coming and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Jean Pfeiffer and I've been a trustee here a long time. And I've been a friend of Betsy's and a colleague of hers for even longer. So I'm delighted to introduce her to everyone, although I know she hardly needs an introduction and everyone here knows very well her great accomplishments. But first, let me just ask everyone to remember to turn off your cell phones and pagers. And also to mention that there are copies of the book, Green Metropolis, for sale out in the lobby. And Betsy would be happy to sign copies after her presentation. On behalf of the library, I wanted to thank everyone for coming tonight and hope that you will remember to contribute to our annual fund, which helps support events like this and keeps us open 7 days a week. Let me get onto the business, which is to welcome Elizabeth Barlow Rogers. She is a native of San Antonio, Texas, and she has lived in New York City since 1964. And she made her name in New York, most famously, I think, as Central Park Administrator and one of the founders of the Central Park Conservancy. And she served in that position from 1979 to 1996. And that's when I was privileged to work with her on the Central Park Master Plan and several other buildings that have been restored. And we were just laughing how so many buildings in the park are still being restored, like the police precinct on the 86th Street Transverse. Finally got done after 30 years or so of our first efforts to do so. So Betsy is now the president of the Foundation for Landscape Studies. She's written 9 books, which focus on, I love this subtitle, Nature, History, and Design, that really explains her work. Two of my favorites, which I hope you will read if you haven't, are The Forests and Wetlands of New York City, written in 1971, before urban ecology was even on the radar for most people, and then her wonderful landscape design, A Cultural and Architectural History from 2001 is really a comprehensive history of landscape design and beautifully illustrated as a reference book, so everyone should have that. So in Green Metropolis, Betsy literally revisits her interest in the ecology of New York City, and she looks at current efforts to preserve and restore the natural settings of New York in public parks in the 5 boroughs. And one thing that's really great, I think, about this book is that she talks about the people who are doing this work, and she goes into great detail about individuals in all 5 boroughs, and some of them are arborists, some of them are ecologists, some of them are sociologists, but just to really talk about those very important people. So, thank you, and welcome, Betsy.
When I became a teenager, my interests were more focused on dating boys and making little excursions in nature, but this early love of the green outdoors was too ingrained to be lost forever. After I graduated from high school in San Antonio, I attended Wellesley College, where I majored in art history. Upon graduation, I got married like most of my contemporaries, spring by spring, and at the age of 22, I became a mother. In 1961, at the same time that my first husband, Ed Barlow, was enrolled in Yale Law School, I decided to get a master's degree in city planning. Following our dual graduation in the spring of 1964, we moved to New York with our then six-year-old Lisa, where I, like so many others, enthusiastically adopted this as my permanent home. No Catholic like a converted Catholic, no And since my focus at Yale has been on landscape preservation in urban areas, I joined the Parks Association, now known as the New Yorkers for Parks, there's Lillian Miller. This gave me my first taste of how citizens could enter into a relationship with government through a combination of advocacy and protest. The environmental movement was not yet born, as you mentioned, because of the encroachments on natural areas that needed to be stopped, I soon found myself protesting the smothering of Pelham Bay Park's remaining wetlands with garbage and marching with the Staten Island Citizens Planning Committee to prevent Robert Moses from building a highway along the island's central woodland spine. And there you will see in my second chapter of the book, we'll visit the Staten Island Greenbelt. And if you look at that map, you'll see that it has the Reed's Basket, Willow Swamp, the William T. Davis Wildlife Refuge, and High Rock. It is one High Rock Nature Center. It is one of the city's most extraordinary natural landscapes, and you will find a chapter devoted to Park in Green Metropolis. This, along with other experiences as a park activist in the 1960s, made me familiar with a number of still green parks in each of the city's five towns, that so much nature could exist in such a densely urbanized place is what provided the impetus for writing the Forests and Wetlands of New York City. Now, this latest book is born out of a desire, I think you said this already, but I'll repeat, a desire to revisit these areas that I had written about earlier. And since the publication of Forests and Wetlands, 45 years ago, since this is really hard, but I was a very young thing. There's been additions to this fabulous 29,000 acre park system. And I wanted, therefore, to write about the older parks, revisit those, and write about the newer parks as well. And not all of them, there's only seven chapters really devoted each to a specific green area park. And you'll find then the additional ones besides Inwood Hill, High Rock, Jamaica Bay Wildlife Refuge. You'll find, I wrote this time about the Central Park Ramble and Four Freedoms Park out in the East River on FDR, Roosevelt Island, it's called, and the FDR Monument on Roosevelt Island. And I also, what about the Highland and the New Park on Staten Island, Fresh Kills Park, which is the story of garbage. And then, as many of you know, there was a 20-year hiatus in my career as a writer. And then my writing was mostly grant proposals and annual reports of the Central Park Conservancy. And then the book called, important, Gene brought this up. Gene was part of this, the management and restoration plan for Central Park. And that really was a wonderful 20-year period. some of the things that she worked on way back when, because the park has never been better managed than it is now. And I really have to say that my legacy is very much due to people that I hired a long time ago and other people that they hired. And I get wonderful compliments, particularly every spring. In fact, I had every blossom on cherry trees. But that's not true. It's really it's the best managed park in America. It's the best managed park in the world. And it still owes a lot to that plan and having a good plan to guide its, not just the restoration, but look why we put the word management first. It has to be managed. And that is what has happened, and it's a joy. I did go on, I felt that my talent really is more entrepreneurial and literary, and that it was time for the, the whole professional or administrative aspect to come to the fore, and that is indeed what's happened. And I'm happy that this book that you also mentioned is now being used in universities and colleges where there are history departments and landscape architecture departments as a text where they have survey courses. And here, back to the book of the day, book of the evening, tonight, it's about cities, parks, and the other one is about cities, parks, and gardens. This one I think what you know already what it's about, so I'm going to leap forward with telling you that you have New York City. First of all, I just want to say that New York City is not a place where nature is scarce at all. You can take a walk in a remote seeming location, like High Rock Trail in Staten Island. You've got all of this wonderful riverside, 500 miles of waterfront in New York. You have biking, you have canoeing and kayaking, you can sail, swim in the Bronx River now. So there is an awful lot of green New York and a lot of recreational opportunities within that. And just think of it, you can take the A line and the final stop is in the park in Manhattan, right at the tip of Manhattan, and you're in a beautiful park, another woodland, and you can see there in here, this is called the Indian Cave, this overhanging piece of Manhattan. It's just not really a cave, but it has a recess there, and people like to fantasize that it was an Indian cave. But what's really interesting, of course, is the fact that Native Americans did live in this area on the shore, and they would probably shelter in the winter right there, which is why it's appropriate that it's called the Indian Cave. And we have Jamaica Bay, and there it's right, like you can see if you fly into Kennedy, you look down and you can see all those marshes in the bay, and it's amazing to think that right there you can have this abundance of wildlife, primarily birdlife. And the person that, I'll get to Don Reapy in a minute, but he said that when he got tired, he was a ranger for many years, and he was heart and soul guardian of the bay, and he said when he got, you never get tired of watching birds, but he would watch the planes, and he can identify every plane. And this is the conflict, because it's no longer up there to be there. So identifying the planes, that's another challenge. And here is an osprey nest. The raptors came back. If you remember, all bald eagles and all kinds of hawks and osprey were very endangered. And then after Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and the banning of DDT, we do have this wonderful, thrilling comeback. And the same person that looked for the planes as well as the birds, he built these platforms, which are great nesting areas. So you can see lots of osprey now in Jamaica Bay. But now take a drive over the Verrazano Bridge, or you can, of course, take the Staten Island Ferry. And Staten Island is just a great place. This is not in my book, but I think this is worth mentioning, the Chinese Scholar Garden and the Tibetan Museum. And of course, my favorite place is High Rock. And here, I do bring in, as I think you mentioned, these are my gurus, the people who really were my mentors. And I had been to these areas, I'm familiar with them, but there's something about the people who are real habitués, who are in these parks every day, and who can reveal things to you. And Mike Fuller is a very special guy, I think. Mike was officially, his title was naturalist in the New York City Park Department. He has retired now from the Park Department, but he's still very active as a New York City naturalist. And this was very thrilling. With Mike, we went to see the emergence of a 17-year cicadas. I knew about the cicadas because when I wrote The Forest and Wetlands, the story of the cicadas, another naturalist had told me about how important this was and how it's just an amazing event. So I went over, and it's called stridulation, all of this, you know, humming and buzzing and very weird, loud sound. And I think Debbie was with me too. We went over and we met Mike, and here's Mike's photograph of one of the cicadas emerging. And I describe all of that in the book. And then, though, the heart is always never far of mine from Central Park. So The Ramble is a chapter that was not in the Forest and Wetlands. I thought The Ramble really deserved some of the chapter in this book. And here, look at this. The book, by the way, has a lot about geology. And because you have to know the bones of the city, what shapes the city, its geography and its topography. A lot of that is geology. And New York has an amazing geological history, and it's easy to read, and particularly in Central Park, where you have the outcrops, these wonderful outcrops of Manhattan Schist, one of the three formations. There's Fort O'Neill, you'll see that mostly in the Bronx. Inwood Marble, you'll see that in the Inwood District near Inwood Park, and Isham Park actually right outside the entrance to Inwood. And you'll see in Central Park the Manhattan Schist, and you'll see that in Inwood too. You'll see it, you know, in various places. But the glacier, the last period of glaciation, the rocks were formed hundreds of millions of years ago. And then these are, think of them, this is crustal plate theory, the mountains being heaved up, and this is part of the Appalachian chain. They roll, they wear down, then they're polished by the glacier. The last, most recent, I shouldn't say the last, the most recent epoch is when, in the Pleistocene, you have this 1,000-foot-high wall of ice just moving across the landscape, and you can see the south easterly trending grooves, and that marks the passage of the ice, and then it stops. And what you have then is the Staten Island is part of the terminal moraine, all of Long Island. The reason the north part of Long Island is ridgy and hilly, and the south part is this flat outwash point, from the glacier. That's why that topography is the way it is. And so here, I take you into the rim, where the rim is really the best spots. You have to realize that the park is totally man-made, that it was, they blasted these rocks. It was like a quarry in a way. So lots of rocks. Look at the Belvedere. Look at all these buildings. Look at the wall. Look at, you know, the sides of the transverse road. These are right there in Central Park. These are pieces of Manhattan schist that then was the stonemasons. You know, they dressed the stone and they used it as building blocks. But then they also, and this is the genius of Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Box, is leaving some of these magnificent outcrops in place. And so here we have the gill, and it just, they use the little crevice and flows right through the ramble. And the ramble also, I talk about the botanical epochs of Central Park, the picturesque original park with vines, and the ramble was very romantic. And then we have the turn of the century, you're importing more plants, and it gets a little more showy with some of these exotic species. But now we have what I have called in the book eco-culture, because it's about the native plants that are being planted today in the way of managing the park. And here, oh, let me see if I can identify this. Roger Pasquier, of course, is here. And Roger has you have a cameo appearance in this book, and Roger is the ultimate guru. And so here we have Northern Thicken. It used to be called a yellow shaft, but now it's just known as Northern Thicken. Okay, I'm always a little hesitant. Here, the rocks. Look at the way in which you see that these beautiful, beautiful rocks are these great, I call them elephantine presences there in the ramble. But look what's happened. The side of that rock, they've sheared it off again so that it makes a wall that, as you go along the pathway here. Here, I mentioned earlier, the stone was dressed and used as building material, and I love the way that the Belvedere, it seems to grow right out of Vista Rock. Vista Rock is there are not many buildings, and the point of Central Park was to be scenic and picturesque, but where you do have a building, this particular one, the Belvedere, it's like an exclamation point in the landscape. So you do have this sitting atop Vista Rock, and it is a scenic viewpoint. You could see it originally from the mall. It was on the axis of the mall. There is the gill. Again, notice how that open material is used. You see, you would think this is a natural stream, but it really is completely man-made. So when you see, here I have a pointer. There's my pointer, look. You can see all these rocks. That's all part of that blasted material that is put there to create the little mini waterfalls. And here's another of my gurus. And I'm sorry the guru isn't here tonight. He's come to some of my other talks, and he's my grandson. And I'm San Antonio. And Henry is now at Columbia. You know Henry, don't you? And he's getting his PhD in geology. And this was really wonderful. He did have a job first after he got out of Oberlin. He worked for 2 years at the Museum of Natural History. So he would just come over and meet me in the ramp. And we would go around and he would explain things. And I told you a little bit ago about the rocks being molten and the valleys of the earth and being formed and then passed over by the ice. And I thought I sort of had the You know, it's a story, but it turned out that Henry really had explained the recrystallization of the metals and how this all happened. And I'd never taken chemistry, you know, and it was really tough. So he kept explaining, I kept asking more questions, he kept explaining, and finally he looked and said, Grandma, you didn't get it right. So the last email, he really explained it, and I thought, this is good. Cut and paste. So it's not plagiarism, but it's definitely in his own words. So we got that story right. And here I mentioned the eco-culture. This is, and the wonderful people who stayed in Central Park. She is Regina Alvarez. Linda, you know Regina very well. And Regina, we hired as woodland manager way back when. And Daniel Atha, do you know him from the Botanical Garden? He's in the herbarium there. And what they are doing right now is they are collecting all of the self-propagating plants in Central Park, and they're being put in the dried specimens into the New York Botanical Gardens herbarium. So we hung out a lot in the Ramble, and Regina's the one who really knows all those plants because she planted many of them herself when she was the woodland manager. And here's Neil Calvinese. Oh, look, Linda's sign. We miss, Neil was there for 35 years, and I remember he was just a young fellow right out of the degree granting programs at SUNY and horticulture. He was our first group of, we call them interns back then, and then he went on to become in charge of all the park horticulture and ultimately park management. And so here you can see this eco-culture that we're talking about. And it's so beautiful. If you remember the Japanese knotweed, you know, it sounds very racist to say an invasive exotic. I mean, that's not, it sounds so politically incorrect. But this plant is really a great spreader. And it's not that it's ugly, it's just that it takes over everything, and did. And so by removing the knotweed, which is a multi-year venture, because it's everything is very sensitive in the Ramble in terms of its restoration, because there are so many bird watchers, and so we have a woodland management committee, and Regina and other conservancy employees work very closely with them. And so this is what's happened. Instead of Japanese knotweed, you have pockets of this throughout the Ramble. You also have a lot of dead trees because a rotting log, obviously it's humus, it goes back into the soil and it provides a lot of insects, habitat for insects, and that's food for birds. And we have bugs. We don't even need watcher to identify this one. Oh, I found that something really interesting. The Baltimore Oriole, this was Lord Baltimore's colors. So, I mean, it didn't come from Baltimore, Maryland. It really is because this is crest, I guess, you know, the colors of the Baltimore family. And so that's why it's Baltimore Oriole. We have the Magnolia Warbler. We have just a host of warblers, of course, that come into the park every spring. And I'm sure some of you have been on these terrific walks. I hung out some with Roger, but also Joe DiConstanzo from the Museum of Natural History. Museum offers walks, weekly walks in the spring and the fall. And they're nodding, maybe you've taken one, people sign up, and it's really great. And so I went out with Joe, and it was sort of like going out with Roger because I would be excited, and I came home, and there were 12 birds that I had seen. Well, then I would open up his blog, and there were 43 birds. And this is just by way of saying how green the city is. As I mentioned it before, but here, Brooklyn Bridge Park is not in the book, but I'm bringing it up because it's just a marvelous addition to the city. There's Hudson River Park. We talked about it. You can go canoeing in the Bronx. And the High Line, of course, is a wonderful addition to the city. To think of taking an old industrial relic and turning it into this aerial promenade is great. That's Roger, Robert Hammond. And Robert is also a San Antonian, as I am, and it's just a great story. And I told a behind-the-scenes story. You know, we've all heard about the Dillard's Graffiti Hall and then James Corner. He's in the book. He's the field operations guy. It's brilliant, their design. It's really wonderful. I wanted to tell that story, but also how those two guys did it. I mean, they were just amazing to see that this most improbable thing could come to me. And so their story is in the book. Robert and Josh David is his co-founder. They always never took any other title other than co-founder of the Friends of the High Line. And you can see with Linda knows Pete and Mary Smith, I'm sure, Pete Outhoff, well, the great Dutch plantsmith designer, garden designer, and he planted. It was just brilliant to take the whole idea of this serendipitously vegetated, it had never been vegetated, just after the rail line was abandoned, up through these rotting railroad ties and in the tracks, grew these wonderful plants. And now in the plant pouch, the High Line. They aren't exactly the same, but they look like wild plants, even though some of them are, you know, pretty great horticultural specimens. But that's the genius of great garden design. And this is designed as a really fabulous garden, but you're not aware of it as, you know, garden. And then for Freedom's Park is another terrific park. And right there in the middle of the East River, it's essentially a greensward, and the French would call this a tapis vert. Think of Versailles and the, you know, line of the alleys of trees on either side, and that is a really interesting story about the old. When I wrote The Forest and the Wetlands, if you look back in that book, you'll see then it was just changing from Welfare Island into Roosevelt Island. And so there's lots of rubble, and even because it was used as hospitals for contagious people with contagious diseases, and abandoned wheelchairs. I mean, it was really weird and interesting to go over there back then. New Town, it's called New Town, End Town, of urban planning. I think it's a success story that grew up there. William Vandenhoevel is really, in a certain way, the father of Roosevelt Island. He suggested to John Lindsay that it be named after FDR, his great hero from days of his childhood. He was a great admirer of FDR. And so the name was changed, and then the great memorial designed by Louis Kahn was designed in 1973, and it was going to be built, but then Kahn died, and the city had financial troubles. This was before the fiscal crisis in the 80s, but there was state money and city money that didn't materialize, so it's over 40 years now since that was was first proposed, and the fact that that was realized. It's like the story I was telling you about something, the fact that these things can come to pass that are the dreams of yesteryear is really wonderful. And so here we do have, this is Collins Memorial, the park is his too, the whole thing. And that's the smallpox hospital up there, which remains as a ruin. I think that's nice to leave that. And here it's, Colin called it a room, and it's open-sided, open roofless, but then the side that's open is looking out at the most incredible views of the United Nations and the fabulous skyline that we know so well. Now, Fresh Hills Park is on Staten Island, as I mentioned, and that chapter is all about garbage and how the city's once vast wetlands have been completely consumed by so-called sanitary landfills. And it's a different sort of park from the kind that Robert Moses, see, Moses would have capped over. Moses was, well, as you know, he designed, Moses is really, he's a hero in some ways. I mean, all of the recreation that he brought to the city, the pools, the beaches, the, you know, golf courses is here. We know that he was very autocratic and really did some things later, particularly that were finally not in the best interest of having a vibrant. Well, it was always vibrant, but I mean, when we read Jane Jacobs later, we realize that there are other ways to build and to restore in the city than tearing down and building. However, look at these. These were kept marshes. I mean, they were marshes that then had garbage dumped on them. Then it was capped, then soil was brought in, and then recreation facilities. Fresh Hills is not going to be that kind of park. There it's being capped. There are four major, huge mounds. This is the last and the largest of the great marshes that were obliterated. And here we have polyurethane, or, you know, being spread like a blanket, and then more soil will be brought. But then you have all that methane down beneath the ground, and so it has to be released. And it will be 30 years before the park is actually open to the public. They do have Parks Department, has what they call a sneak peek, and that's once a year, and so you can go out there, and it's really fun. Climbing on these mounds is great. I mean, it's, you see again, like the highlight, nature's just taking its course. And so you've got this, there's the skyline of Manhattan, and then all of this wonderful waving grass in the wind. And there you've on the edge, you have, is this Arthur Kittle, or no, it's, which Kittle is it? Dutch. I'm losing this, but there you have the waterway going through this landscape, the big creek that the Dutch call Kills. And here is methane being processed in this plant, and then some of it, I mean, some is being released through the pipes, but other methane gets pumped into this plant and then distributed as electricity on Staten Island. So there is some environmental good that is going on. But now, I was babbling on methane and gases and all those things. So enough of that. I'm just going to say my last word, sum up. Have to show you one more picture of Central Park, and one more picture of it, which has green and red on it, if you can make Christmas presents. Nice color. my favorite subject, the Parks of New York. Thank you. Spaces are great, and they can be parks themselves almost. And I know people who have gardens on their rooftops and are gardening away and part of the local food movement. And I think New York, that's a great question because it does bring up the greenness is not all on the ground. We do have greenness, we have our penthouse terraces, we have a lot of green rooftops. And I know you're speaking of the kind word, it's energy efficient, and we have that too.
What's the plan for Fresh Kennels? Is it going to be a park or a natural area?
It's really called a park. It's called Fresh Kennels Park, but it will be a natural area in the sense that it's really interesting. This is design, the term design with nature is something that naturalistic design, and a lot of us are very big proponents of that. This is really not, it is designed with nature, but it's almost designed by nature, because nature is just being allowed to redeem this site, if you will, this great garbage dump. And so it's being carefully kind of nurtured, through nurturing nature along for over 30 years. But it's an interesting plan. I won't be here to see it, but maybe our grandchildren will, and you can see it. I mean, it's fun to go out there. It's just that the admission has to be limited because of all this, activity with the sanitation department. Still, it's officially the Department of Property, but the sanitation people are still there because they manage all of that, the elimination of the new. Yes?
How do you feel about dogs and the parks?
Do I feel about dogs? I should ask Ted, who's right behind you. He never met a dog on his morning runs in Central Park or anywhere else in the city that he didn't want to say hello to. And I think dogs are great, and I think that the Central Park Conservancy's done a brilliant job of having the dog. We don't ever want dog runs in the park because that's doing something that is very wrong in my opinion, which is sequestering pieces of a multi-use public park, a special interest use. So I think that the way in which the dogs are allowed in some places and not in others, and that land pieces of very damaged lawn or restored, and dogs go somewhere else. But all of that is the art of park management, and the dogs are considered as, an element of that. Laura?
I have another question about Fresh Kills. You said that the garbage was capped over, so, and then soil put on top of that. So I'm just wondering about the technology of that. Is rainwater then allowed to go through the capping to kind of return it to a sense of marsh, or does the rain simply pour off the whatever is used to cap?
We need an engineer. I don't want to give you bad information. I do know that, that there's plenty of water. Does anybody else have an answer to
yeah.
this?
Yeah, we have an engineer over here.
Well, I'm jealous, actually. So the capping is impermeable, but then they put a lot of soil on top of the capping, so the natural habitat is above it.
Yeah.
You don't want that cap to puncture, because then you're exposed to all the garbage and contaminants that are underneath it. So the purpose of the capping is to keep the two environments.
It's that layer of topsoil. I mean, here's the thing.
Yeah.
You can't plant big trees there
right.
because the roots would go down. So when we saw all of the grasses are growing on the soil. So it's a soil surface. Yeah, I should have known that. But then you don't plant trees because you don't want that barrier penetrating.
So my first question was, you know, what are they going to do with it? So do we see the possibility of our sled riding there 30 years because it is a big hill? Is that part of the use of it? Or are people going to be walking up this several hundred foot tall?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I think they're probably still going to sled on Pilgrim Hill and Cedar Hill in Central Park. I don't want to, you know, make a guess. But that's what's so wonderful about parks is that people find all sorts of uses and uses that you wouldn't expect. And that's what makes them really wonderful is that people find in these parks their own special interest. So whether it's sledding or biking or bird watching or meditating, the parks are there for all of us and they serve us in so many different ways. Yes?
I'll just comment that this library has some wonderful sources on at least Central Park. I haven't checked the others, but when I was doing some work for my own neighborhood history. They have a tree census of Central Park, in 1888, and then another tree census of Central Park in the 60s. And you can go through, and for the area that I lived in, you know, you can trace which ones have spawned, which ones have died, and they have a lot of colorful stories about how different trees got there. So anyway, the library is a great source to bring to preface your book.
Oh, this library is so great. And I have done research here too, and I found great material on Central Park here. But also in writing the Forests and Wetlands, a little book about the springs of Manhattan that come out of the ground. That is in my bibliography. And I mean, many books that are really very precious and tell about the place because this is the New York Society Library. Yes, Charlotte.
As the water rises and it's going to rise, how have they protected all the investment in Roosevelt Island parks along the rivers? How is that being
I'm not sure.
How
is it being protected for the future?
Meaning, how will it not be flooded?
How will it not be flooded? You know, really, you're coming at me with these questions about, no, when I said engineering, and then we figured that one out. Okay. You want some help on the, give me some help on the, this is really an issue. And it's a great issue because we are in the midst of climate change. There's no question about it. I'm not sure what in our lifetime is going to be done that makes a difference, but I do know that today landscape designers are designing with some kind of flood control mechanisms in mind. Yes.
So to follow up on that, they are planting saltwater resistant plants on the land and along the edge now. It's something reviews since Sandy, and it brings up what my question was. I took part in the hearing that City Council just held on inaccessible places in our city parks. And I brought up the Stanton Building on the Lower East Side, which is inaccessible now, but could be a fantastic location for a resiliency center. Do you think parks in the future are not just going to be teaching us about the environment, but also teaching us about sustainability and resiliency?
Yes, I do think that's a great mission for parks. Lyndon, do you want to say something about New Yorkers for Parks and how the advocacy for sustainability and we do have community gardens, don't forget, and with the local food movement is certainly thriving in New York. But how do you feel about the future of parks and their educational potential for sustainability?
Is that we must get the city to provide the resources to maintain these places. The mayors, the recent ones, build huge parks, and certainly Brooklyn Bridge Park is to die for, it's so beautiful. But it's terribly concerned about how it's going to raise enough money to maintain itself. We have 29,000 acres, 1,700 parks, and we spend 1/4 of 1% of the city budget on our parks. So
but sustainability in that sense is maintenance, and it's operational budget, and it's good management. But then you're also talking about the sustainability. I think that word sustainability, it has so many meanings, different meanings, but in terms of the ecological meaning.
Yes, all of the different kinds of things you've described are there because some of the wonderful people who decided to love them and kept them going. And hopefully more and more people care about parks and the environment. And so hopefully we will continue to support our parks in the best way we can. That's what New Yorkers for Parks does.
Well, thank you all very much.